As an historian, Niall Ferguson is interested in the account, the chronicle, the history of catastrophe. The latest, this virus still infecting the world, got him thinking about what it is these disasters tell us about a society. Why do some respond so much better than others? Why does politics sometimes cause a catastrophe? So there are plenty of examples in his latest book, and one happened decades ago, though he'll never forget it.
T-minus 21 seconds and the solid rocket booster engine gimbal now underway. T-minus 15 seconds.
I'm old enough to remember the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster on January 28th, 1986. I think I was a student at Oxford.
3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission.
From the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded.
Like many people listening, I was transfixed by the appalling sight of the space shuttle blowing up just after it was launched.
We will report more as we have information available. Again, to repeat, we have a report relayed through the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded.
I don't suppose I thought terribly deeply about why it had blown up. I think at 22 you kind of shrug your shoulders and say stuff happens. But when I started thinking about the history of disasters, I realized I couldn't really leave that disaster out. I think I wanted to understand better why the shuttle had failed. And it turned out that there was a wonderful answer to this question by the physicist Richard Feynman. And he ended up writing a kind of dissenting opinion and a book about his experience of the inquiry into what had gone wrong. And it was an epiphany for me to read that. At the time, there were journalists who wanted to find a way to blame the president. And there was a story that the launch had been hurried up because Ronald Reagan wanted to refer to it in a speech. But it turned out there was no there there because actually there had never been any serious intention to mention it. The real story, Feynman discovered, was that the NASA engineers knew there was a 1 in 100 chance the space shuttle would blow up. But the bureaucrats at NASA turned that into 1 in 100,000, which is quite a big difference. For reasons that Feynman speculates about, they wanted to keep the program going, they didn't want to tell the true nature of the risk to the people writing the checks in Congress. And there's an extraordinary moment in Feynman's account when one of the engineers explains how he arrived at the 1 in 100 number, and there was this enigmatic figure, Mr. Kingsbury, in NASA middle management, who insisted that it was 1 in 100,000. But the engineer could never get a meeting with Mr. Kingsbury, and nor could Richard Feynman. So Mr. Kingsbury becomes this kind of enigmatic personification of bureaucratic mismanagement. The epiphany for me as I read through Feynman's account was that when disasters happen, you're tempted just to blame whoever's at the top. But on close inspection, the point of failure is rarely right at the top. Whether it's a pandemic, the Titanic sinking, or the space shuttle Challenger blowing up, there's Mr. Kingsbury in there somewhere. And part of the historian's job is to look for Mr. Kingsbury.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Niall Ferguson is with us talking about his book called Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Whether they're natural disasters or not, Ferguson says most are usually, at some level, man-made. Take a pandemic. Ferguson says, sure, it's made up of a pathogen, but also by the social networks it attacks. So you won't learn the right lessons if you just study the virus itself. You have to know the network part, too. Neil Ferguson is a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and we began our conversation with his preoccupation, his fascination with disasters.
Well, my wife will confirm that preoccupied is an understatement. I was obsessed with it from January 2020 when I first got an email about a strange new pneumonia in Wuhan from a medical friend. I think the answer is that, yes, I'd studied contagion in various forms for many years. It's a kind of difficult thing to avoid if you're a historian with my interests. For example, writing a book about World War I back in the 1990s, I was struck by the statistics on the German army's state of health. One of the fascinating things about the end of the war is the sudden surge of soldiers in the German army reporting sick in the summer of 1918, which previous historians had attributed to a kind of silent strike, i.e. they'd lost faith in the war effort. But I began to wonder, as I was writing the book, if it could be in fact a reflection of the Spanish influenza, as it was known, a great influenza pandemic that originated in army camps in the United States, but ended up spreading across the Atlantic and all around the world. A devastating pandemic, by the way, much, much worse than COVID-19 in terms of the percentage of the world's population that ended up killing. So that was one. Then, even earlier than that, I'd been writing my doctoral dissertation about the city of Hamburg in the 1920s. But in writing the sort of prehistory of the story I was interested in, the introductory chapter, I had to address the extraordinary cholera epidemic that had happened in 1892 and was much influenced by Richard Evans's book on that subject, Death in Hamburg. Fast forward a few years and I'm trying to write a history of the British Empire. And the most striking thing about running an empire in the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries was that the more you tried to establish yourself in the tropics, the more you had to deal with infectious disease. And the mortality rates for British soldiers who were deployed to tropical colonies were just staggering to me. So I could go on. The truth of the matter is that any historian who's serious about understanding history broadly, doesn't really matter which period you study or which geography, you'll do well to avoid the problem of infectious disease, of epidemics and pandemics. So your antennae ought to have been twitching at the beginning of 2020, because the stories coming out of Wuhan were just the sort of stories that you see at the beginning of major outbreaks of disease. I still remember the kind of cold shiver down the spine I got when I saw that first email about a strange pneumonia in Wuhan. It's just the way previous pandemics begin, with a little bit of news about something a little bit strange, very often, though not always, in an Asian city.
I guess we should point out the book is not just about the COVID pandemic. I mean, you've described it as a general history of catastrophe. So there are those general lessons, what you're saying, that we can learn from these.
Absolutely. This book is a general history of disaster, not a history of a pandemic that isn't yet over, though I write about it in the later chapters for obvious reasons. And I think there are general lessons to be learned. One of them we've already talked about, the Mr. Kingsbury problem, that in many disasters, the point of failure is not at the top necessarily. Another broader point is that all disasters have a political character. That's why the subtitle of the book is The Politics of Catastrophe. That if you try to draw a clear distinction between natural and man-made disasters, it's a little bit artificial because, well, clearly a war is a man-made disaster that men, mostly men, start and fight. And a pandemic begins with some new pathogen like SARS-CoV-2 or the bacillus that causes the bubonic plague. Ultimately, it's how we respond to a threat that determines its scale. So I'll give you an illustration of this. We would all agree that a volcanic eruption is a natural disaster, but if it happens on an uninhabited island, it's not really a disaster because nobody dies. But if there's a really large city or a complex of towns next to the volcano, then the decision to settle near a volcano is the thing that causes it to be a disaster.
You mentioned in the book your first encounter with the word doom. You were a boy in East Africa. It was the name of a bug killer. And then, of course, you talk about how the word is shot throughout popular culture and literature. In other words, as you say, doom is alluring. And I wanted to ask why. Why is doom so alluring for us?
Well, it's a great question. One of the starting points of the book is that we're fascinated by doom, by the idea of complete and irrevocable disaster, the extinction of humanity, the end of the planet, even the universe. It figures in all the great religions in some shape or other, most obviously in Christianity, in the book of Revelation, but it's actually in Islam pretty much copied and pasted. So religion has a kind of bias in favor of catastrophic ends. Even a cyclical vision of religion will have a catastrophic moment after which rebirth comes. And we're fascinated by doom in, I suppose, more trivial ways. It's a huge part of the genre known as science fiction. That's to say that a really surprising amount of literature, since Mary Shelley's The Last Man 200 years ago, is concerned with doom in various forms. Actually, the genesis of this book was a decision I took back in 2018-19 to read a lot more science fiction so that I would give my historical brain a sort of reboot to think a little bit more about how the future is imagined by writers. At any event, we're fascinated by doom. Movies get made about massive earthquakes and, of course, about pandemics. And it was, to me, especially interesting that people were sat during the lockdowns in the US watching the movie Contagion as if somehow wanted to make their own flesh creep by seeing a much worse pandemic than the one that was playing out. But here's the oddity. Although we think a lot about it and find the end of the world so interesting, we love predicting it. It's one of the things that makes modern environmentalism slightly disconcerting to me, the desire to make predictions that the world will end in 12 years, or is it now 10? But when it comes to a real live disaster, an actual pandemic or some other form of disaster, we struggle really to respond and act like it's something completely out of left field. And this is at the heart of the book, the kind of disconnect between our fascination with disaster and our strange inability to manage it when it strikes. There was a very familiar pattern in early 2020 that we veered from complacency in January and February and into March, a time when I couldn't get many people to take seriously the notion that a really big pandemic was underway. And then in mid-March, we flipped to kind of, or at least in parts of the US and certainly many parts of the world, to a kind of overreaction and started behaving as if it was actually as bad as 1918-19. And this inability to sort of get it right and kind of get that calibrate the response correctly is a recurrent feature of the history of disasters. That you go from this state of denial to this state of panic, and neither state is actually particularly helpful. Mm.
Well, you mentioned that there are those who are warning of these, these impending doomsday scenarios. And we should mention, as you do in the book, that there are plenty of secular ideologies like Marxism and others that have their own idea of apocalypse. The population bomb, by the way, is another thing that you work through in the that scare. I guess it was the 70s.
Absolutely. The truth is that although one can find the sort of origins of apocalyptic thinking in religion, in the modern period, it's remarkable how often secular ideas of impending doom have captured the imagination. And you mentioned two there. Marxism is fascinating because although it claims to be a kind of theory of politics and economics, in fact, it's a political religion. And at the heart of Marx's writing, it's right there in Das Kapital, is this notion that capitalism is going to collapse in this spectacular end time. And that when you read it, is so obviously kind of borrowed from religion. In the more modern times, of course, we've got this preoccupation with the climate change specter. But before that, there was the population bomb and the argument, which really was enormously influential in the 60s and 70s, that the rising population of the world was so serious a threat that you needed to have quite drastic measures to stop it. And I talk about some of the programs of mass sterilization and that happened in India. And then, of course, all the extraordinary measures that were taken in China to restrict families to one child. And many of these secular versions of the apocalypse are kind of mistaken. I mean, capitalism has crises, but it doesn't collapse in the way that Marx envisaged. And in any case, replacing it with socialism or communism has generally turned out even worse. And the population nightmare, as it seemed, was preoccupying people when the world's population was much smaller than it is today. And in fact, it turned out that just by improving agriculture and moving people into more productive forms of activity, the Earth could certainly feed a larger population. So I think one of the fascinating things is the way in which we move from one scenario of doom to another. And usually, although we tell ourselves we're being very scientific, unlike our predecessors, our ancestors, in reality, there's an element of the old fascination with the end time in even the most sophisticated accounts of what's going to go wrong for humanity.
Neil Ferguson, his latest book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Neil Ferguson is our guest for the hour, talking about how it is that all disasters are, on some level, man-made, whether they're natural or not. His book is a general history of a disaster, how they share certain characteristics. Basically, he wants to know why some societies respond so much better than others. One of the things he explores in the book is how most of us ignore the possibility that we ourselves could get caught up in a disaster. It's what's known as the optimism bias. And for Ferguson, that kind of wishful thinking is perfectly conveyed by a little ditty sung by British soldiers who were fighting in World War I.
If you were a British soldier in World War I, as my grandfather was, your probability of getting killed or wounded was pretty high. And if you were deployed to the Western Front, to frontline position, it was frighteningly high. So how do you deal with that if you're an ordinary, I guess my grandfather was 17, 18, 19 when he served? Well, the truth is you don't really think very much about that probability of stopping a bullet or more likely being blown to pieces by a German artillery shell. You try to put that out of mind. And the way that this is best encapsulated, I think, is by the song, The Bells of Hell. The bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling? Oh, grave, thy victory. And I've known that song for many, many years. I don't quite know when I first heard it. But delving into its history for writing Doom was wonderful, because I came across this extraordinary letter in which an officer describes hearing the men singing it and writes home about it. And there's a really interesting discussion about what it conveys. And I think the answer, which is the one that the contemporary commentators arrived at, is that this is men laughing in the face of death, because only with gallows humor, only by kind of laughing at it, can you cope with the really terrible risk that you're running. So we, in some ways, this is a reasonable response. I think many of us took this view, at least some of the time during the Cold War, which, again, I'm old enough to remember. The truth is that we didn't walk around in a kind of anxious state expecting Armageddon every day of the week, even although we knew that there was some risk of a catastrophic nuclear war. We just got on with our lives as if it wasn't going to happen. And I think that's a very classic coping response when you're aware of some disastrous scenario, but it just would be paralyzing to dwell on it too much.
I hope this isn't jumping around too much, but I think about that idea that you were talking about there in contrast to another idea where you later in the book where you describe how a pandemic can create, as you describe it, a pandemic of extreme behavior. And you write about the religious extremism that took hold, for example, in the 1300s during the Black Death, and these flagellant orders. Maybe tell that story and talk about that as a reaction, because I found that fascinating.
Well, again, this was something I'd come across many years ago in Norman Cohn's book, The Pursuit of the Millennium. Once the disaster of the Black Death had struck Europe, which was a disaster probably larger than any other in recorded history, the Black Death, which was mostly bubonic plague spread by fleas and rats, killed 30, 40, 50%, depending on where you look, of the European population. We don't have great data on its incidence in other parts of Eurasia, but one estimate is that this thing killed about a third of humanity, vastly, vastly larger in its impact, in other words, than any modern pandemic, and certainly vastly bigger than the COVID-19 pandemic. So nobody knew really what was causing this terrible new disease to sweep through Europe. What they tried to do, assuming that it was a reflection of divine dissatisfaction with mankind, was to ward off further retribution with rituals of expiation. The flagellant orders were formed somewhat spontaneously and outside the control of the Roman Catholic Church all over Western Europe. Started in Hungary, but spread all over Germany and further west into France and the Netherlands. And these bands of men would wander from town to town, sometimes as many as 500, whipping themselves, literally. So they would form groupings outside churches and whip themselves in quite elaborate rituals. And this was a very classic response to disaster in the face of a really mysterious surge of mortality. People find themselves seeking some kind of solution in the realm of religion. Of course, there was no way that doing this would help matters. It might even have made matters worse, because wandering from town to town during a plague is probably not the best strategy. But I think when one reads accounts of the flagellant orders and the way that they behaved, you realize that as human beings, when we're confronted with a sudden and very severe disaster, we react with a great deal of mental anguish, and we desperately want to do something to ward off this danger. So I would say, if you contrast our soldiers in the Western Front with the flagellant orders, you get these two different mindsets which we can have. One is not complacency, but the sort of determined gallows humor, and then the other is this kind of almost hysterical reaction in which you behave in a very extreme way, hoping through magical thinking that you'll somehow make matters better.
Are you seeing something akin to flagellant orders in the response to the COVID pandemic?
Well, I'll choose my words very carefully here. There were moments last year watching what was happening in some of the protests that followed the killing of George Floyd, when I wondered if an act of collective expiation was in fact happening. The scale of the protests last year, I think, was unimaginable without the pandemic and the lockdowns, because, of course, people had been cooped up in their homes with great restrictions on their freedom for a good long time before the great wave of protest. Some of the scenes were, I think, quite clearly religious, and indeed explicitly so. The scene I describe in which a group of white protesters wash the feet of two black pastors, or the white protesters who actually had, I think, made up rather than real whip scars on their backs. There's a lot of expiation going on in 2020, and in the midst of a pandemic, great crowds form to talk about the problem of police violence towards African Americans. If you were viewing this from, let's say, a distance of centuries or many thousands of miles, you'd be forgiven for thinking it was a strange time to have that conversation in the midst of a pandemic. I mean, yes, you could have a debate about public health, but why policing and race at that particular moment? So in no way to diminish the importance of the issue and the realities of the issues of racial discrimination that have actuated Black Lives Matter as a movement, there was definitely a kind of religious dimension to this extraordinary wave of protest that, for the historian, seemed at least comparable with past moments when a natural disaster coincides with or triggers a great wave of political or religious response. And there are other examples that I give in the book. It's fascinating that at the very moment when the Spanish influenza is sweeping the world, having started in 1918, there's a great wave of an ideological nature going on as well. The Bolshevism meme, if you like, the virus of Bolshevism, as it was frequently described in the time, that began earlier. But it's actually a global moment, 1918-19, when it suddenly seems as if the Russian Revolution is going to be global and is going to expand far beyond the Russian Empire. So I think there's an interesting kind of comparison one can draw there. And many people at the time did. It's fascinating how often you see references to Bolshevism as a plague. Winston Churchill frequently made this kind of allusion. So I think in history, disasters often have this twofold character. There's the thing itself, the virus or the bacillus, and then there's the kind of the mental plague or the mental thing that goes viral.
It made me wonder, and maybe it's not the same thing, but I've heard you talk about progressives, for example, in California, wearing masks these days as a badge, maybe not so much as an act of expiation, but as proof that they're not conservatives. But are masks in some ways symbols? Have they become symbols?
What's odd about our situation in the United States is that everything has become politicized, including things that in the past really weren't. The debates in the 1950s about infectious disease are striking to me because there's not much sign that there's a partisan divide over, say, vaccines. When masks became a contentious issue last year, I think it was partly because of mixed messaging, confusing messaging from public health authorities, which, if you remember, went from saying, no, you don't need to wear a mask, because they actually were desperately short of masks and they didn't want the public to panic buy them when they needed them for the health professionals. And then the shift occurred and we were then told, no, you absolutely have to wear masks. And this I think, set a kind of sequence of events in motion which led to the politicization of mask wearing. President Trump contributed to that by very explicitly saying that he would not regard the advice to wear a mask. And from that point on, masks became associated with the Democrats, and not wearing masks became almost equivalent to wearing a MAGA hat. This didn't happen everywhere in the world, but it certainly became an issue here. And it wasn't the only one, because you got similar kind of politicization around certain remedies for the virus, hydroxychloroquine being the most famous, which turned out not to be a remedy, and then vaccines. So I think one of the striking features about modern American history is the way in which politicization, polarization, and partisanship have spread into areas of life where they weren't always present. Having said that, I should point out that there was an anti-mask movement in California in 1918-19, because San Francisco was one of the cities where they tried to mandate, and indeed they did mandate, mask wearing for periods of time during the Spanish influenza. So there's a bit of a track record of American hostility to mask wearing, just as there's a bit of a history to anti-vax sentiment that goes all the way back to the very earliest experiments with vaccination against smallpox in the late 18th century. So there is a history in the United States of wariness, at least towards certain public health policy measures. But I think that waned. And by the mid-20th century, and what strikes me looking, for example, at the 1950s, is that public health was not politicized. That in the 1950s, vaccines were something everybody was in favor of, pretty much, apart from a relatively small proportion of religious opponents. And Americans were rather proud of the fact that they led the world in vaccination. So my sense is that we've gone quite a long way away from that in recent years, because now everything is subject to partisan division and intense and sometimes bitter debate.
Well, spend a few moments with 1957, I'm thinking of in particular, and because you write about the success of Dwight Eisenhower's response to all of this. I had no idea that he had been important in overseeing the efforts to deal with the flu, the influenza epidemic, pandemic in 1918 as a young officer, and that strategy you mentioned, trust doctors, use social distancing in 1918, mind you, and then how fast forward he applies those lessons as a president. Talk about that. That was fascinating.
Well, Eisenhower did have a close encounter with the influenza pandemic problem on two occasions. First, when he was a still relatively junior army officer overseeing a camp that was stricken by influenza, and really learning from working with the medical doctors how best to deal with a virus against which there was no vaccine, and indeed the consequences of which were frequently lethal for young people. When 1957 came along and a new strain of influenza appeared first in China, the response of the US government, I think, reflected Eisenhower's experience. That is to say, he turned to his public health people and said, well, what do you think? And they said, well, we can't stop this spreading. It's going to spread very rapidly. And we should therefore focus on getting a vaccine as fast as possible and otherwise minimize the disruption to economic and social life. Now, I should say that the two cases are not exactly the same. That is to say, 1957-58 is not the same as 2020-2021. Yeah. But those two cases are much more similar than they are to 1918-19, which was much, much worse. If you look at, say, the proportion of the world's population killed by COVID so far, certainly on the official statistics, though they may underestimate the casualties, but on the official numbers, we're looking at about the same proportion of the world's population that the Asian flu of 1957-58 killed, about 0.04%. COVID is going to be worse in the end. It has further to run, and it's certainly already been worse in the United States, because actually the United States had a relatively mild experience in 57-58 compared with some other countries. Still, as I said, if one's looking for good points of comparison, 57-58 is a better one than 1918-19. And it's unfortunate that we didn't really talk much about 57-58 because it's largely forgotten. I didn't even know much about it until Nicholas Christakis drew my attention to it early in 2020. And I delved into it thinking this was a really fascinating study in contrast. So you got roughly comparable public health challenges. Certainly at the beginning, in the initial phase, policymakers in 1957 had as much or rather as little clue about how bad it was going to be as policymakers in January, February 2020. But what's really fascinating to me is the way the Eisenhower administration essentially says, here's some money, not much money, by the way, to get the vaccine development expedited. That's it. No state of emergency, no school closures, no lockdowns. And I've thought a lot about what that tells us. Partly it tells us that we had options they didn't have. You couldn't tell people in 1957 to work from home. Almost nobody could. There was no internet. Many Americans had no telephone connection. So we had options they did not have. But I think also their attitude towards a new infectious disease was very different. In other words, you kind of accepted this kind of thing as part of life in 1957. Polio was still a problem, of course, in the 1950s. You'd just been through World War II and the Korean War. And remember, this is a disease that kills young people as well as older people. Although it may have killed more Americans, COVID-19 has disproportionately killed people over 65, whereas the Asian flu in 57-58 disproportionately killed teenagers. So in some ways, it was a scarier phenomenon because kids and very young children too were vulnerable to it. People, I think, took it much more in their stride. And when I talked to contemporaries, including people who were sick with the virus, they do comment on the different mentality of that time. And I think I'm too young to remember it myself, but I've chatted about it with many Britons and Americans who lived through it. I think they're struck by how very different our reaction has been to COVID-19. We certainly didn't take that in our stride.
Neil Ferguson, his latest book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Neil Ferguson. We're talking about his latest book, Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Now, I guess I should say by way of a disclaimer that you have been as critical as, I guess, the next person of Donald Trump's response to the pandemic. But there's this recurrent theme in the book I wanted you to talk about. And, you know, it's the idea you mentioned from Tolstoy in War and Peace that we just attribute too much responsibility for disasters on leaders, on incompetent leaders or any kind of leader. Talk about this as an idea in the book.
Well, you're right. I'm highly critical of Donald Trump's handling of the crisis and do not spare him. Indeed, list a great many of the mistakes he made that I think made matters worse.
I think you lost count.
Well, I did. I if you ask me how many mistakes, I would definitely be north of a dozen major ones and probably another dozen that were less disastrous. But it was a kind of cascade of misjudgment. And I think it's important not to downplay that, and I don't. But if we conclude that the lesson of 2020 is that we had the wrong president, and if we'd had a different president, if Joe Biden had somehow got the job a year earlier, or if Hillary Clinton had been president, it would all have been fine, and we wouldn't have had nearly 600,000 deaths, I think we're deluding ourselves, because that can't be true. The reason it can't be true is, first of all, there were plenty of countries with liberal leaders in Europe, for example, that did just as badly or worse. Secondly, and I think more importantly, one can't attribute too much control to the president over something as specific as the public health response to a new pathogen. There are people whose job it is inside each government's bureaucracy to deal with this threat. There's an undersecretary for preparedness. There are a whole bunch of people at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention who work on this. And there are others in other agencies in the Department of Health and Human Services who do this for a living. And they did not do a great job, and nor did their counterparts in most Western countries, compared with other countries that reacted much more quickly and effectively to the new virus. I'm thinking here of Taiwan and South Korea in particular, but Australia too did a much better job of limiting the exposure of the population to the virus. So did New Zealand. And I think we need to ask ourselves what exactly went wrong. Because if you say, well, we just had a terrible president, you're not going to learn anything from this, because you're going to think we've solved the problem.
Well, and you're not paying attention to the middle manager who actually blew it.
It's Mr. Kingsbury, who in this case, in a way, is the man who was the Undersecretary for Pandemic Preparedness, Robert Kadnec, whose role has scarcely been mentioned in the media over the last 18 or so months. And I delve into this a bit, because here's something that I don't think is properly understood in the wider public, especially by people who feel good about blaming Trump, which I think is a lot of people. If you look at the number of pandemic preparedness plans there were, going right up to the year before the pandemic, on paper, the United States was well prepared for a pandemic. In fact, an international assessment that was carried out in 2019, which was published by the Economist Intelligence Unit, put the US at the top of the world rankings for preparedness. So on paper, the US was prepared for a pandemic. It got a very good report from the WHO, the World Health Organization's joint external evaluation too. So we can't, I think, entirely explain what went wrong by saying Trump made terrible errors of judgment, because I think the same things would have happened whoever was president. For example, CDC should have, as fast as possible, ramped up testing, which you were able to do early on once the genetic structure of the virus had been understood. There were tests available very quickly in South Korea and on a large scale. That did not happen in the US. You couldn't get a test, even on the Stanford campus, which is quite good at science, I'm told, for months. And that was because CDC had said, first of all, nobody can develop test kits apart from CDC. And then it sent out a test kit that didn't work. And this was enormously damaging, because if you couldn't find out who had the virus, you could really do nothing to limit its spread. That the successful combination in Taiwan and South Korea was you did rapid testing. You made sure that you traced the contacts of anybody who'd been infected, and then you isolated them and quarantined anybody who might be suspected of being infectious. We did none of that. And I think we would have done none of it even if Joe Biden had somehow been in the job 12 months early. And here's a clinching bit of evidence, which I came across after finishing the book. So often the case, isn't it? So Ron Klain, who's Joe Biden's chief of staff and did that job when Joe Biden was vice president, admitted in 2019 that if the swine flu of 2009 had been as bad as COVID in terms of the virus's infection fatality rate, they would have been in just as big a mess. It's just that the swine flu, though a lot of people caught it, was not very lethal. But I think that's a very honest admission on his part. I think we should recognize that when disaster strikes, while the buck stops with the president, just as it stops with the prime minister in the UK, you shouldn't pretend that therefore the president is sitting there taking decisions about the likely contagiousness and lethality of a novel coronavirus out of Wuhan. That's not what presidents do. Jim Fallows wrote a piece for The Atlantic last year, which I violently disagreed with, in which he compared the president to the pilot of a light aircraft. That is not what being president is like. And Jim Fallows must know that. In truth, the president sits atop a huge bureaucracy of 60-plus different agencies, at least five of which I think had some responsibility for pandemic preparedness. And the decision-making process is a series of arguments that kind of find their way up the bureaucratic hierarchy until they finally reach the president. And even then, there are still people in disagreement amongst his advisors. So I think we need to recognize much more clearly the general lesson that Richard Feynman taught us, that in a disaster, strong though the temptation is to blame the man at the top, and just though it is to find fault with Trump, that can't explain why things went so badly wrong in the United States when on paper we were supposed to be prepared for a pandemic.
I want to finally come back around to something you were mentioning before, this effort you had been thinking of, had made. You'd been wanting to write about a history of the future, to go back and read all of these dystopian ideas and books and see who got, as you put it in your book, who got the future most right. And there's this concluding section in the book you call Future Shocks. And there's an epigraph from Aldous Huxley's Brave New World there that I wanted to ask you about. I'm not sure if you have it to hand, but it seems to express something important, this idea. Shall I read it or do you have it in front of you?
The epigraph at the beginning of that final section of the book is committed to memory. "All right then," said the savage defiantly, "I'm claiming the right to be unhappy." Brave New World's a wonderful book that everyone should read. It's not enough to just read George Orwell's 1984. If you're going to read dystopian fiction, you also need to read Huxley's Brave New World. Because in some ways, I think Huxley got the future more right than Orwell. Orwell's vision was that because of the nature of nuclear weapons in the post-World War II world, there would be three great empires, one essentially American, one essentially Russian, one essentially Chinese, and they would all be totalitarian states. They would all have mass surveillance and brutal repression, and there would be nothing other than that kind of what he called slave state. You could say that something of that has turned out to be true in North Korea, and maybe it's getting to be true in China, but it's certainly not been the experience of the Western world. Actually, Orwell's fear that we would just end up as a totalitarian system turned out to be wrong. Huxley's vision was different, and interestingly earlier, because of course he wrote before Orwell. He taught Orwell at school. Did you know that? That's my favorite little factoid, that Huxley was Orwell's French teacher at Eton. Wow. Huxley's Brave New World is a world in which a consumer society has achieved a kind of appearance of harmony, mainly by drugging people and allowing them to enjoy a permanent state of bliss. Of course, Huxley also imagined eugenics as the dominant form of this new order, but what he got right was that the consumer society would sedate us into compliance rather than brutalize us into compliance. And in the end, the savage in Brave New World is a kind of Dostoevskian figure. It's a bit like Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. I'm going to be unhappy just to spite you and your damned system. I offer as a conclusion the thought that we should be as worried about totalitarianism, both Orwellian and Huxleyan, as we are about climate change or the next pandemic. Because totalitarianism killed a hell of a lot of people in the 20th century. It probably was the single most deadly thing to happen in the 20th century, just measured by tens of millions of prematurely dead people. So I offer in the concluding Future Shocks chapter not only a kind of science fiction history of the future, but also a kind of reality check. There are a lot of things that can go wrong. There are a lot of disasters that can befall us in the coming years. To think that only climate change is the one to worry about, I think, is myopic.
Neil Ferguson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Ferguson, he's a writer, historian, currently a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. His book is Doom, The Politics of Catastrophe. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.